Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the latest episode of Borders Blatherings, the podcast where Mary Craig, historian, and I have a chat about the curious, shadowy, and often magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Very well, actually.
Good.
I think the cough may have gone, so let's hope I get through the whole podcast. In the hours leading up to our meeting to record a podcast, often while I'm out walking with Cassie, I take my mind back to school days, usually to the history lessons that I received,
right,
to see if I can drum up a topic to pick your brains about. And this morning, while doing that, I did go back to school days. Now, we did Latin, we did French, mathematics, and my favorite subject, which was history.
Uh-huh.
But I ended up in the music class.
Oh, okay.
And I have this, don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to join me in any song or whatsoever. But I have this image in my mind's eye of the music teacher, very straight-backed, sitting at the piano, having handed out song sheets for the class to sing.
Right.
Together.
Uh-huh.
Communality. A togetherness. And one of the oddest songs, and I remember it well, that we were ever asked to sing was "A Frog He Would A Wooing Go." And I still have this picture in my mind's eye of the frog with his grey felt opera hat at a jaunty angle,
okay,
and his silver-tipped cane, uh-huh, off to go a-wooing.
Yep.
But I'm not going to ask you to sing that.
Okay.
Do you know that? It's a kind of nursery rhyme.
I do, yes.
If I remember the lyrics, it doesn't end well because he's gobbled up by a duck or a swan at the end.
Yes, he's eaten by something. I can't remember what, but he does get eaten up. Yes,
This jaunty young frog who's off a wooing. I was thinking more of a time when a king he would a wooing go. And maybe the end of that, which I will pick your brains about, ended up with Scotland being gobbled up by good old England.
You could say that, yes.
With the Union of the Crown in 1603. Maybe not. You'll put me right on that. But I'm thinking of good old King Henry VIII and has become known as the Rough Wooing.
Indeed, yes. Known by the name that Walter Scott gave it. So there's our first Borders connection straight away.
Oh, so the Rough Wooing is a phrase coined by Walter Scott?
Walter Scott, yes.
Okay.
And he has, in recent years, come in for quite a bit of criticism for doing so.
I can get that, because linguistically, rough wooing is a bit of a contradiction.
Yes.
Is this to put a more gentle face on war, bloodshed?
A war that continued for years and was extremely severe in the number of deaths, the number of casualties, and the disruption to life in, guess where, the Borders.
Yes.
So I'm really surprised at Walter Scott for that one.
Uh-huh.
I really am. Yeah.
Because the impact of that is felt mostly in the lowlands and the Borders.
Yes.
It's not a Highlands issue in a sense.
The furthest north they go is St Andrews for a little bit of a day out to St Andrews. But no, it's Edinburgh and the Borders.
Yes,
and
St Andrews Castle was captured. Oh, I'm going back a long time to history lessons.
Brottie Castle,
Yeah. So we're back in Borders Blethering's territory.
Absolutely.
Which is 100%. The history of this part of the world.
Yes.
Could we start then with the background to the rough wooing? I'm going to naively say to you, it all really starts when Henry VIII divorces himself from the Catholic Church. Would I be right in thinking that?
Yes, that's one of the starting points. is Henry's decision that he wants to marry Anne Boleyn, his bide-in, as we might call her in Scotland.
The bide-in, yeah.
Unfortunately, he's got a wife at the moment, Catherine of Aragon, and he can't get a divorce from the Pope because the Catholic Church frowns on divorce.
Yeah.
So Henry throws a bit of a hissy fit and decides he's going to divorce the Catholic Church instead. I'm being a little facetious here, because Henry initially was known as the defender of the faith, and it was the Catholic faith
exactly.
he was defended.
Yeah.
He was a very staunch Catholic king. But as I say, he was in love with Anne Boleyn and decides he wants to get rid of Catherine of Aragon. Poor old Catherine. So he divorces her, and he divorces himself from the Catholic Church, sets up the Church of England, and puts himself at the head. Marries Anne Boleyn, everything's lovely. Except Anne Boleyn doesn't give him a son either, because that's what Henry wants. He wants a nice wife and a son. Catherine of Aragon didn't give him a son, she gave him a daughter, Mary.
Yeah.
Anne doesn't give him a son, she gives him a daughter, Elizabeth. And he keeps on going until, hooray, Edward appears. Little Edward. The problem was that Edward was a very sickly child. And Henry was getting on a bit when Edward was born. So you've got the fact that he has divorced from the Catholic Church, and this is the very early start of the Reformation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So England is becoming a Protestant country. Scotland is still Catholic.
Because the old alliance is still...
Yes, the Scots and the French are best buddies.
Yeah.
Now, remember when we did our Great War podcast just a wee while ago, we talked about Germany's genuine fears of encirclement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sort of England had the same.
Indeed.
Because England and France are aye fighting each other.
Yeah.
And because Scotland has made this alliance with France, England feels a bit encircled. We're sort of, Scotland's sort of sitting at England's back door, as it were. And they don't like this. Now, they weren't really encircled because we were too small to invade England. Although we kept doing it just to annoy them because, well, it's fun, isn't it? So Henry is wanting Scotland to change from being Catholic to Protestant. Uh-huh. And he genuinely wanted that, as did some of the very senior English families, such as the Bullens, such as the Howards, these big English families.
Uh-huh.
They were pushing for the Protestant Reformation. So they want Scotland to be a Protestant country, and that sort of isolates France, and that would sort of break up the old alliance, because France was definitely staying Catholic. They also want to close their back door, and what's the best way to do that is to have a nice little marriage between little Mary, Queen of Scots, little baby, and Edward. The Scots weren't too chuffed about this. They didn't really want this. And there's various skirmishes going on, and there's a battle at Solway Moss, which the Scots lose.
Yeah, yeah.
James V is very severely injured in this. And there's a peace treaty. Is sort of cobbled together. Now, while the peace treaty is being cobbled together, James V dies. Mary Queen of Scots is born, and Henry goes, ta-da, there's a princess for my prince. Which would mean that Edward, when he became king, would be King of England and King of Scotland.
Uh-huh.
As part of the peace treaty, Mary is to go down to London to be raised in London. And that's it. And the Scots lords agree to this peace treaty.
Because so there's an issue going on of not only, in a way, religious unification, but the idea of the union of the crowns is in existence by this time. They are pushing towards a united.
Yes. Well, when I say united, it's not a equal partnership.
Well,
England is going to rule Scotland.
Indeed.
Now, the Scottish lords agree to this because, well, they've just been defeated in battle. It's a bit difficult to sort of, you know, demand terms when you are the loser. So everything's fine for a little while, and Henry's quite happy down in London, everything's sorted, and then after a few years, Henry says, right, okay, the baby's now no longer a baby, the baby's now a toddler, let's get this marriage done. You can do a marriage by proxy for little ones. Only the Scots have changed their minds, of course, because James V is dead, and the regent is Mary of Guise, Mary Queen of Scots' mother, who is French. And, of course, as far as she's concerned, it's the old alliance. As far as she's concerned, her daughter's marrying a French prince.
Yep.
Thank you very much. So the Scots initially sort of drag their heels for a bit. And Henry gets a little bit angry. And they drag their heels a bit more. And Henry gets angrier. And then they just turn around and they say, ah, no, we're not really going to bother. Thanks, but no thanks. We'll change our minds.
So just so that I'm clear on that, there is an alliance agreement in existence at one point?
Oh yes,
that
absolutely
commits
yes.
young Mary to yes. Edward.
There's a treaty. Signed,
yeah.
sealed, and delivered. Uh-huh. And as Scott said, treaties can be made, treaties can be broken. Uh-huh. You know,
yeah.
I mean, people break treaties all the time.
But this is in a way, it's part of the, I was going to say enlightened, it's not. But when you have the ultimate power grab, instead of just sending an army to war, one way is through different houses intermarrying.
Yes.
It's, in theory, a gentler way
yes.
of carrying out yeah. a power grab.
And the thing was that Henry VIII was actually Mary Queen of Scots' great uncle.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
You know. Because her father had been married to Mary Tudor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the Scottish and English royal houses have been intermarrying for years. I mean, royal families are intermarrying.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at the British royal family today.
They're yes.
You know, that's what royal families do. There are very few noble houses in which to find a bride. So, you know, it wasn't unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So Henry decides this is what he wants. And the northern lords in England, the Percys and the Nevilles, who had not converted from Catholicism, they sort of wanted it as well. Because what was happening was, as always happens in a border, people don't really recognise a border, or they don't recognise
yeah.
a border when it suits them. So there was a lot of cross-border skirmishing going on,
yeah.
as had been happening for years.
Yeah.
But the Nevilles and the Percys, they're saying, oh, this is great. So all of England's going, right, so we get Scotland to stop annoying us at our back door.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be a snub to the French. We'll have a nice, pretty little queen, and Edward can have lots of babies with her as early as possible because we know he's going to pop his clogs. He's not going to live for long.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we can push the Protestant religion. So there's lots of positive
yeah.
reasons.
You can see that.
For the English yeah. to say, we want this marriage to go ahead. Scotland, however, splits in two. So you have the English faction and you have the French faction. The French faction, as I say, is led by Mary of Guise. The problem is you've also got people like Cardinal David Beaton up in St Andrews,
mm-hmm.
who's got an awfully bad habit of burning Protestants. Now, it really annoys people when you do that. If you burn a heretic to death, it quite, you know, the family get yeah. quite annoyed about this.
Indeed.
You know. So although most Scots are Catholic, Beaton's not exactly doing their cause a lot of good by burning people all over the place and screaming and bawling and shouting and jumping up and down while still having mistresses of his own and various other bits and bobs. So there's all these different tensions within Scotland. And of course, Scotland is a small country. And having an old alliance with France is all very well, but France is all the way over there. England's right next door. So there's a tension there. There's quite a bit of a tension there. So as I say, the Scots sort of renege on the treaty. Henry loses his temper and decides, right, I'm going to go up and teach them a lesson. So he dispatches several thousand troops via ship up to Edinburgh and several thousand troops up who stomp all over the Scottish borders.
Yeah, because you don't send thousands of armed men up to Edinburgh without coming through this part of the world
exactly.
and causing a bit of mischief, yeah. I would
and
imagine.
That was the start. That was 1542, and that was basically the start of what at the time was known as the 8 or 9 Years' War,
uh-huh.
depending on your opinion as to when it finally ends. Now, the troops do go into Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
They burn Holyrood House. They burn Holyrood Chapel. They burn yep. most of the Canongate. They loot everything they can find. Didn't quite take Edinburgh Castle, but they caused complete mayhem
yeah.
in the capital city. Yeah. And the troops in the borders cause chaos. They attack all of the border abbeys. They attack all of the border towns. They start building forts in places like Lauder.
I was going to say, do they build fortresses?
They build fortifications.
Yeah.
They take
yeah.
over Roxburgh Castle. They
yeah.
take over all of these places.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do what they always do is, they billet themselves on families in the borders,
yeah.
whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
They beat up the young men. They molest the young women. They burn the crops. They steal the crops. They steal the cattle. They steal the sheep. And there is nothing you can do about it. And for about 8 or 9 years, depending on your opinion, the south of Scotland, the borders, is under English martial law.
Yeah, because they're not retreating back
no,
to England slowly.
Absolutely not. No, they just sit there. They just sit there.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, the problem is that, of course, poor old Berwick-on-Tweed gets it,
yeah.
as it always does.
Yeah.
the English are burning the Port of Leith, so the Scots can't get any help from France because there are no ports for the French to land in. Mary of Guise is furious, and the French do send troops over, and pitched on battles occur in the borders, in places like Ancrum, all over the place.
There is an Ancrum field battle, if I remember correctly.
Massive battles all the time. Now, again, they're not fighting every single day. But when they're not fighting, as I say, they're under martial law. Now, it's not that they were under English law. So there's the Scottish legal system and there's the English legal system.
Yeah.
They weren't under the English legal system. They were under martial law, which meant that soldiers could act with impunity. So if you're a properly trained soldier, you might actually, you know, get up in the morning and do what you need to do and, you know, pay for your keep or whatever, right? Mm. The vast majority of troops were just having a gay old time, beating up lads in the marketplace, molesting young girls, stealing whatever they could lay their hands on. And this happens for 8 to 9 years. It's constant, and the borders just bears the brunt. And so the French troops who go over relieve Leith, they relieve Edinburgh. Mary is in Linlithgow Palace, and they move her here, and they move her there. And eventually what they do is they get Mary onto her ship and get her across to France to get her to safety, which makes Henry even angrier. And so he doubles down on the troops that he sends into the Scottish borders. Henry dies, and you think, oh, well, okay, Henry's died, he's going to calm down. Oh, no, no, no. The regents on his behalf, Somerset and the others, decide, no, we absolutely want Mary to marry Edward. Even though by this time, the Scots have now got a treaty with the French, and they're saying, we're going to marry him, marry Mary to the Dauphin. Doesn't matter. And the English spend years and years and years sitting in the Scottish borders. Estimates vary as to how many died over this period, but something like 18,000 deaths, something like that.
Yeah.
And the disruption, and they did things like, especially in the Scottish borders, if you opposed the English faction, if you were part of the French faction, they would turn up at your doorstep. You might be a bonnet laird, you might have a little bit of a farm, or a big bit of a farm. They would turn up, and they would drag you off and chuck you in prison, and they would put an English landowner in your place and physically give them your land and your titles. And that happened right the way across the borders. And it's really interesting about the propaganda war that they ran at the same time, which was really weird. So they're physically turning up in the borders, beating people up, molesting girls, killing people, stealing crops, taking people's land and title from them and giving them to English sympathisers. And they're running this propaganda war saying, oh, but if they just got married, everything would be lovely. We would all be friends together. You know, and you don't really want the friends, do you? Because, I mean, they're a bit, you know, they're far away and they're not really like us and they speak French and they eat garlic and stuff. And, oh, we're your pals. It was a really weird propaganda war.
Are the English, so the English are planting, it's not spies, but agents in this part of the world.
Yes.
And presumably are they pointing the finger at the church in Scotland rather than the military? Are they saying that it's because of the church that these soldiers are taking on the English? Is there a finger pointing going on?
There is a bit of finger. I mean, interestingly, initially the Douglases, of course, are Lowland. They were in the pro-English camp initially. But then when the English come up and start stomping all over the borders, the Douglases are saying, well, you can't do that. That's ordinary people. That's our people you're stomping all over. So they turn and they go into the pro-French camp, even though the vast majority of them had actually become Protestant. So the religious element sort of oozes away, if you like. And it just becomes this war of attrition. And in the borders, you end up with a very interesting split in opinion. So you get half of the people on the borders absolutely flaming angry at what the English are doing. And they join the French camp, not because they're particularly pro-French, but because of what the English have done. They've stolen my crops, my daughter, they've killed my son. But then the other half of the borders are actually in the pro-English camp, not because they like the English, but because they are pragmatic and say, look, if a bully slaps you every single day, it's bad. If you make friends with a bully, they might only slap you once a week. And so they weren't particularly pro-English. They were just worn down by it. because these were families that had had generations of this. We've had the Scottish Wars of Independence. We've had all of these different things. And it becomes the family legend of your great-great-granddad this. And people can see burned cottages from 200 years previously in the Wars of Independence. And when they started, we spoke about this in our Abbeys podcast. The abbeys weren't, so, I mean, they weren't burned to the ground and things like that, but they were attacked because, of course, we're getting to the end of Catholicism in Scotland and the start of the Reformation. People are attacking holy houses. And you think, this is never going to end. We're going to have to make some sort of peace deal with these people because there are 10 times as many of them. And that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was why I always liken it to the mixed response you got in the Scottish independence referendum coming up last
week. That's what I am
9 years ago,
at.
Isn't it? Where you have a strongly yes vote in Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
Because, of course, Glasgow looks to the Ulster Irish. And at that time, Glasgow and the West were very much in the pro-French camp.
Yeah.
You have Edinburgh, which is in the pro-English camp. You have the Borders, which is mixed, and all these different things, because people have to live in a border. It's all very well to say, oh, well, you know, you should fight the English.
Mm.
How many generations of border peoples had to fight the English all the time?
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
And it's very curious that this war just drags on and drags on and drags on until eventually the only reason the war sort of stopped was the fact that England was fighting with France at the time, of course. They were also fighting in the Italian states and they needed the troops. They needed the troops elsewhere. And when Mary is betrothed to the Dauphin in France, the English sort of, I think they realise it's not going to happen. She's not going to marry Edward. Get over it. And I think there was also the fact that I think there were quite a few in the English court that didn't want a marriage at this point because Edward had been a very sickly baby.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And if you go all the way back to Henry VIII's father, there were an awful lot of noble families in England. Who didn't he think the Tudors should have got the crown anyway?
Uh-huh,
and Henry VIII never called himself a Tudor. Tudor was, it was almost an insult. You're just some jumped up wee Welsh guy. So the Howards and the Bullens are looking at him thinking, ah, Edward's not going to make old bones. Well, no, but there's no point in getting him married off because...
Ah, so they don't want that line to continue.
They don't really want that line to continue. Uh-huh, whereas Elizabeth, well, she's a Bullen, isn't she?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so although at first it was, yes, absolutely, and the pride of it and all the rest of it, but because Scotland by this time was starting to turn Protestant, so the religious element, that's drifted away.
Yeah.
The French are using it as an excuse to have a battle, and that is costly. They didn't have a lot of money. And then you're looking at Edward and you're thinking, is he going to live much longer? Is he even going to be capable of fathering a child? Because look how many wives his father went through.
Uh-huh.
Henry VIII went through 6 wives, got 3 children, 2 of whom are useless girls.
Uh-huh.
Is Edward going to be any better? This is our opportunity to push that another way. So when the betrothal between Mary and the Dauphin are announced, that's when the English lord starts saying, enough's enough.
Yep.
Enough's enough. And they start to withdraw, and they start to withdraw from southern Scotland, and they withdraw from the borders. But the devastation they left behind was immense.
So all the loot from the looting and pillaging leaves by ship from the port of Leith, from Edinburgh.
Yes.
But the troops themselves are slowly going...
The troops themselves are slowly going south.
And spending a lot of time and creating a lot of damage here in the borders.
And of course you have, like anything at the tail end of a war, the soldiers are not always paid at the tail end of a war.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've been taken from your family, even if you're a professional soldier and you spent 7 or 8 or 9 years up the Scottish borders, and now your pay's not coming through, and, you know, you're a soldier. You have an objective. I am going to force a marriage. Oh, right, after 7 years of that, we haven't achieved our aim. So what was I up here for? Why was I away from my family from? And where are my wages? Right, I'm going to nick everything I can. So every bit of plate or silver that anybody in the borders has gets stolen by the retreating English troops.
So not just land,
Scottish landowners who had lost their property when it was given to English settlers, they didn't get that back. In a lot of cases, they didn't get that back. Mm. They went to the courts, but it was very difficult because if you go to the Scottish court and say, I used to be farmer X and I had all that land and the English came, threw me out of my house and gave it to an Englishman, the Scottish court say, oh, right, legally, that was imposed by a foreign body. Can we, you know, how do we have the legal authority to overturn that?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the landowner's screaming, what are you doing? Give me back my land. And judges and lawyers are always very cautious. They will say, yeah, but that could set a precedent. Because if we overturn something that they have done, then they can overturn something that we do.
Yeah.
So actually, we're really sorry, Jimmy Fiselkirk, that you lost your farm. Suck it up, basically. That's all we can do. And, you know, people who had lost their land are saying, but well, can I get compensation? And they said, well, we haven't got anything left. The English have nicked everything as well.
Mm-hmm. So, historical parallels are fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
I believe, without having any facts at my jolly old fingertips, that it's my experience that support for Palestine is very strong in Scotland, perhaps a wee bit stronger than it is in other parts of the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And I see some parallels there with displacement.
Yes.
It suck it up. It's such a...
That's it. Just get on with it.
Yeah.
Get on with it. There's no compensation for you. We can't give you compensation because, again, that would set a precedent. Everybody would want compensation. But we can't because we physically don't have the money because the English have nicked everything.
Because we've been at war.
You know, we've been at war, which we've had to fight. Also, the English have stolen. I mean, they absolutely stripped Edinburgh of everything they could. Plate and money and everything like that has gone.
Yeah.
And as I say, if we start making rulings over something that they did, because it wasn't as if the English had imposed a law in Scotland. It had, because it had been done under martial law, that's really difficult because that's you're difficult. An occupying force. And while you are an occupying force, the legality of martial law is really iffy.
Yeah.
Because internationally, do you accept it or not? You're talking about Palestine and you're talking about, you know, there are settlements in Palestine that people would say, well, I've got the right to live in this house. Yeah. Well, no, I'm sorry, you haven't anymore. You're going to have to move and, you know, that lad's getting your house. Martial law and possession and it's very, very difficult. And this propaganda of, well, you know, we needed to do it because we had to push these things forward. So we needed those settlers in there. So we need people to be supportive of what we're doing. And I can understand the people in the borders who were in the pro-English camp.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In my heart, I would be, oh, I would be in the French camp. Absolutely.
Yep.
But on a day-to-day basis, if my son's going to get beaten up, if all my cattle are going to get stolen and my sheep and my pigs and my chickens... But if I'm in the pro-English camp, maybe that might not happen. I can see why people would say, oh, fine, I'm going to be in the pro-English camp then.
You mentioned the vote more recently on Scottish independence, and I can see that that plays in very strongly, that feeling.
That feeling, because especially if it's something, if it's something that you have very little control over and something that is sort of like a, I don't know, a level of economics you don't quite understand or something, you think, well, actually, I can sort of work out how that camp would be a better camp for me on a day-to-day basis, no matter what my heart's telling me, my head's telling me something different. You know, it's very difficult if people are put under pressure. And when Walter Scott comes up with the rough wooing, now he comes up with that because he had promoted Scottish history, and he did magnificently. Absolutely, he did. Yeah. But as we've said, he was both a nationalist and a unionist.
A unionist, yeah.
At the same time, the problem was that because England is bigger, it just is, it's physically bigger. There are physically more English people than there are Scottish people.
Yeah.
It's very difficult if you're trying to promote the union and if you then have to say, oh, but by the way, you lot were a bunch of bullies that came down and did this. And of course, the trouble is that if you start picking at it, especially at a border, neither the Scots nor the English were blameless. They were always picking at each other. That's the problem with the border.
Yeah.
So I
the debatable
know,
lands.
The debatable yeah. lands, yeah. of course, yeah. it's the same as the English Welsh marshes, yeah. you know, so yeah. it's very difficult. I mean, after the war was over, the border was put back to where it was, and the English troops all had to withdraw south of the border, and they did. But as I say, the legacy they left, this always looking over your shoulder, always uh-huh. keeping one eye out for the English who might be coming back up again. And then, of course, it just becomes this repeating cycle of, well, they came up here and beat us up, we'll go down there. And so villages and towns that are right on the border mm-hmm. get this constantly.
That you can see why that would emerge as one way of pragmatically dealing with that. You mentioned at the beginning that it was, I'll give him Sir Walter Scott, who coined the phrase rough yeah. wooing. It's mm. a bit strange, actually. Was this an attempt to put a kind of more gentle face on the bloodshed and the war that had
so.
Broken
yes.
out? You say he came into a lot of flack because of that.
He did later on, yes.
Because?
Because people were aware of what had happened.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I know he was a romantic, and so all the wooing, and, you know, I mean, because it gives you, you think of some poor lad, a Romeo and Juliet situation, and the family are saying,
yeah.
you cannot
yeah.
marry our daughter, and you go through all of this, and maybe the Romeo gets beaten up, or whatever, and that sounds very romantic, and he's, you know, he's going through all these different trials and tribulations to get the girl.
Mm-hmm.
But people were being murdered.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a professional army came into the borders
mm-hmm.
and killed people. They killed ordinary people because the Scots army was in Edinburgh, defending Edinburgh Castle, because
yeah.
that's where it sits.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they knew that troops had left on ship from London and they were coming up to Port of Leith.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the Scottish army is sitting in Edinburgh.
Yeah. Yeah.
The borders is completely unprotected. So you have got farmhands and rural workers and fishermen and foresters facing a professional army.
Mm-hmm.
And it was slaughter. It was just slaughter. There was no other word for it. So to call that a rough wooing, no, I think Walter Scott was wrong in that one.
It's a bit like a kind sadist.
Yes, it was very much, it was a war.
Yeah.
And it was called a war at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I say, the fact that it didn't, and of course the English liked it being called a rough wooing afterwards because they hadn't achieved their objective,
yeah, yeah.
you can write it off as a sort of romantic
uh-huh.
phase.
Yeah.
Oh, it wasn't, you know, Henry VIII wanted his little son to be marrying his great niece and it was, oh, how
yeah,
sweet
yeah,
and,
yeah.
oh, such a shame and, oh, there was a bit of this and a bit of that and all, but it didn't work out, you know, oh, the romance of it. Whereas if it's, Henry wants to force the Scots into a marriage they don't want, a religion they don't want, and subservience to the English crown. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
Which is what he wanted.
Yeah. So Mary, Queen of Scots, will eventually marry the French Dauphin.
And indeed.
Am I right in thinking she then goes over the sea to France when she's 5 or 6 years old?
Yeah,
she's a child.
She's 4 years old when they manage
yeah.
to get her out.
Yeah.
And they continue fighting.
Uh-huh.
They were furious that
yeah.
she got to France.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although why they think that a 4 year old should be in the midst of a battlefield, I'm not quite sure. What did they
no.
think her mother was going to do?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, if
yeah.
Mary agrees, uh-huh. like, get my daughter out of here, I want her safe.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a threat that the English were more or less going to come and kidnap her.
Yep.
I mean, as far as they were concerned, they were going to come up and snatch Mary,
yeah.
trail her back down to London. She would have been raised in the English court, and then at the age of 14, I mean, there would have been a marriage ceremony straight away. If they'd got their hands on Mary, they would
yeah.
have taken her down to London.
Yeah.
She
and
could have been married to Edward.
Yeah.
At the age of 4,
yeah.
she couldn't have said no. She would have been married by proxy. Somebody would have said, I do, on her behalf.
Uh-huh.
And then when she was 15, there you go, marriage consummated. That's what would have happened.
It's a
to
bit
her.
Like a little family drama. You know, if we can't have her, then you can't have
yeah.
her. And,
well,
and that's it.
Yeah. Well,
know?
I mean, it was a family drama. I mean, Henry, as I say, was her great uncle. You know, so it was this ridiculous family
yeah.
situation because
yeah.
Henry, we have to remember, Henry was, in a way, a late medieval king. And medieval kings are supposed to win in battles, which he never really did, provide for his court, which he never really did, and produce male heirs. And he only did that the once. So he had a real problem. And he knew, you know, by 1542, he wasn't going to have any more sons. It wasn't going to happen. He could have all the illegitimate babies he wanted. He wasn't going to have any more legitimate sons.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hello, my name is Alison Larkin, and I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of the Jane Austen podcast. This podcast brings Jane Austen's stories to the 21st century, along with commentary from me and conversations with fascinating people who all share a love of Jane Austen. And of course, we had to start with none other than Pride and Prejudice. So join me as we embark on a journey through some of the most wonderful stories I know. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Talking of Henry VIII, the popular image of this man is a rather rotund, well-fed, grumpy old man.
Yes.
But am I not right in thinking that when young, this was quite an erudite, well-read
Absolutely.
Person?
Henry was an absolute catch. He was young, he was good-looking, he was tall, he was physically very robust. He was learned. He was educated.
Sporting. He was pious. Yeah.
Everything. I mean, he wasn't going to be king because he had an older brother, remember?
Yeah.
He was the ultimate. Well, he was a catch. He was a catch that everybody, all the princesses of Europe wanted to marry Henry. Even though he wasn't going to be king, he was better looking than his brother. Yeah. He had a nicer personality. He was a lovely, lovely guy. We remember the Holbein painting, Bluff Hal.
Well, that's the image that has kind of stood the test of time.
But it's one of those what-ifs in history.
Uh-huh.
If his brother had never died, would we even know of Henry? You know, if his brother had never died and Catherine of Aragon had produced a son to his brother.
Yes.
He'd have been one of these footnote princes. He'd have been Prince Charming. He'd have been one of these ones. He'd have had adventures on the continent and kissed all the girls and, made it into the storybooks like that.
Kissed all the girls? Indeed. Like George Ipotti.
Indeed. Or maybe if Catherine of Aragon had had a son that had lived. Perhaps if that had happened, who knows, the English Reformation might not have happened the way it did. Might not even have happened at all.
History is full of what ifs.
What ifs, yeah. Exactly. But Mary Guise was a remarkable woman. Her husband has died. She's French and Catholic in a country that is starting to turn Protestant.
It's turning, yeah.
Her husband has died after a horrific injury at the battle. She is faced with a whole load of Scottish lords, none of whom like her because she's French, none of whom like her because she's a woman. And several of whom don't like her because she's Catholic. She's got a daughter who is days old when this all kicks off.
Yeah.
Literally days old. And she's having to deal with all of this.
Yeah.
She's having to deal with Protestants burning Catholics and Catholics burning Protestants and the English stomping all over Scotland. And she was criticised. She was heavily, heavily criticised for not defending the borders. But she couldn't get any of the Scottish lords to come down and do it. They all went, no, we're sitting in Edinburgh, or we're sitting in Stirling.
Yeah.
You can understand why, because those are the two military strongholds. Yeah. But it did mean that the borders was left to bear the brunt of all this fighting. The borders was left to having, you know, English troops building forts at Lauder and you know, just devastating the countryside.
You've been doing, I'm going off track a little bit here, but you've been doing a project with the school kids, the local school kids, on forts and castles in this area.
We did, yes.
There's a book coming out, am I right?
It is, yes.
Yeah. Publicity. Are many of these forts, castles and other establishments built as a consequence of the Anglo-Scottish Wars?
Not that we're aware of. Most of them predate that.
Uh-huh.
Because what they did when they came up to the borders was they weren't building forts in that way, because the borders is quite a sparsely populated area. It's quite a scattered population. You would get English troops billeted on you. So if you were the local farmer, they would just pitch up and there'd be 20 soldiers now in your house and you have to provide for them.
Mm-hmm.
They would build encampments, sort of temporary encampments, around towns, or they would just go in and be billeted in towns. That was basically what they were doing. And there was a constant movement of troops north. So you might have somebody billeted on you for a fortnight and then they'd move further north, and then somebody else would be billeted on you for a fortnight and they'd move further north. So there was a constant movement of troops up and down.
And common practice, when the romantic in you is first confronted with the fact that, say, Cromwell billeted his troops and his horses in the Great Hall at Edinburgh Castle or in Rosslyn Chapel, you think, what? Did they have no respect?
But that's it, I mean, they burned Holyrood's chapel.
Yeah.
You know, they're burning holy houses. They're attacking holy houses all over the place. As I say, if you think about this, sort of 1540s, I mean, we're just about to go into the 17th century where we've got the chaos of the Civil War.
Yeah.
And you've got 100 years from that, you've got the Protectorate, and the borders is hit yet again, and it's put under martial law yet again. Yeah. So you have the Wars of Independence, then you have the Rough Wooing, then you have the Cromwellian Protectorate. No wonder we were desperately trying for Darien to get some money so we could stop this happening.
And then, of course, Scotland, because of Darien, as we've already talked about.
And you have the 15 and the 45, where people are devastated, and then when you get forced into the Treaty of the Union. So on every occasion, it's the borders that gets the hit, because it is geographically next to England. It's rich farmland as well, because the English army, in an army marches on its stomach, that's the old adage. If you if you come up, and you're the English army, you can either march all the way from southern England up to Scotland carrying supplies.
Mm.
Is it not just easier to eat off the land?
Yep.
So you carry supplies that take you so far, and then you get up into the nice Scottish countryside, you go, oh, lovely, there's crops, there's sheep, there's cattle, there's pigs, there's chickens, there's marketplaces where they make bread. I'll just have all of that, thank you very much, and I'm not paying. Now, but, obviously, senior officers were supposed to pay for any supplies they took, but they didn't.
Yep.
And, you know, if you're a soldier, you can't be bothered. You're just going to take what you want. And they did.
Now, you've said that the English troops hung around here for a long time in the borders.
Yep.
And as they slowly withdraw, there's a bit of Scotch theft policy going on as well. So not only can they feed off the land on their way up.
Yeah.
They can deprive, just to add insult to injury, they could deprive the borderers of their livelihood on the way back.
Because, again, as a professional soldier, you're sent out to do a thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't achieve your objective, so you are angry. You're called back and you think, well, stuff the Scots, never got on and didn't marry their stupid little princess. Right, fine, I'm setting fire to their crops. I'm going to steal all their chickens as I go past.
Yeah.
And then they leave. And, of course, they've left behind all the babies that were born as well.
Yeah.
All those little bit and all those girls that have shamefacedly now got 2, 3, 4-year-old children because the English soldiers came up, and some of it would have been consensual.
Yeah.
The vast majority would say was probably not. But what can you do about it? You know, so again, you've got another generation of children growing up in the borders with, I know who my mum is, don't know who my dad is or was.
Yep.
And so again, that feeds into that psyche. So I can, as I say, I can understand why you would think, oh, better to make friends with a mum. It's better to make friends with a bully than try and fight a bully in some situations.
In some situations, yeah, I think you're right.
Because it's constant. If it had been a one-off, you'd say, all right, no, get lost you. But it's constant. It's sort of every couple of hundred years the Borders gets a hit.
And does the at the end of the rough wooing, as Scott then called it, is this the last major battle in the Anglo-Scottish War of the 16th century before 1603?
Before you go into the 17th century, yeah.
Yeah, so because then we have Darien.
Oh, yeah. So you finish off around about 1651, and then 50 years later, within living memory, you start all over again.
Yeah.
You start all over again,
History repeats. Mary, thanks a lot. That's my real history lessons come when I sit and chat to you. Rather, I had a great history teacher at high school. Don't get me wrong. It was my favourite subject, but I always learned much more talking to you. But one question to summarise before we finish this. In your opinion, was it inevitable that Mary, Queen of Scots, would fall into French hands? Is there an inevitability about that?
I think so, yes.
Uh-huh. That's my feeling. But
even if the rough wooing had not happened, who could she have married as she grew up?
Mm.
Because by the time she was of marriageable age, Edward was dead.
He's gone, yeah.
So, and her mother's French. The old alliance is still in place. Her mother is French. There's a very strong pro-French faction in Scotland. I think it was inevitable that she would have, with a French mother. Yeah, I think so.
Mm.
Because even if she had been forced out by the Lords of the Confederation, well, that was a little bit later, but, you know, even if the Scottish faction had said to Mary of Guise, we don't want the French here anymore, and pushed her out, she physically has control of her daughter.
Yeah.
You know, she physically has her daughter in her possession, which I know sounds like a really odd phrase to say, but in those days that mattered.
Yeah.
I know for all the mums out there who are now clutching hold their children's hands, it wasn't like that in those days. You know, royal babies often didn't see their parents.
Yeah.
Royal babies instantly went to wet nurses, and you might be in one palace and your child might be in another. The minute the rough wooing starts, Mary of Guise makes sure that she is physically in possession of her daughter for as long as possible. So, yes, I think she would have ended up in the French court no matter what. And, of course, as the Reformation pitches up, Mary of Guise is quite rightly wanting her daughter to be safe in the French Catholic court.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Who knows if she had married Edward, what would have happened? But she didn't. And, as I say, Edward never married and never had family.
Well, Mary Queen of Scots and choice of marriage partner, is it? That's a podcast episode.
Well, that's a podcast in and of itself. I always feel very sorry for Mary Queen of Scots.
Me too.
Because I think that history has painted her as this silly little airheaded bimbo, flibbertigibbet that doesn't know what she's doing. But if you think of the circumstances, so it starts off where, her father dies before she's born. People start fighting with her. She has to leave the country.
Yeah.
She's brought up in the French court. She comes back to Scotland. She is French. She's coming back to Scotland. She's Catholic. Most of Scotland Protestant.
Yep.
She is female. They are male. You know, everything's stacked against her. I don't understand why people seem to, all of the qualities that Elizabeth I had, people say, oh, she was a great diplomat and she was politically doing this and she was very this and this and this. So Elizabeth I gets all the positives and Mary gets all the negatives.
Yeah.
If you actually look at the policies of Elizabeth I, she was incredibly cautious. She did very, very little.
Mm-hmm.
People say things like she was very tolerant in religious terms. It wasn't tolerance. It was timidity. She did nothing because she was too scared to do anything. She was incredibly cautious. Mary was slightly more headstrong, and if a couple of things had gone her way a bit better, And the way she was treated by Elizabeth by being in prison for as long as she was ridiculous.
Yeah.
That was ridiculous.
That was.
But again, that goes back to Henry VIII.
Mm-hmm.
Because families and thrones, and Mary was entitled to the English throne as much as she was to the Scottish throne.
I think we have families. To end on that one, because many Scots will claim that Mary had a very legitimate claim to
absolutely,
the English throne.
Absolutely, yes, through her family connections. Yeah. That's the thing with royal families. Mm-hmm. They intermarry, and their alliances and allegiances give us lots of joy in history, because we can talk about it and blather about it.
And James VI and First will eventually get his hands on the English.
Indeed, he will get his hands on both.
And that'll end well.
Yes.
Mary, thank you very much. That was fascinating. Thanks a lot.
Bye for now.
Bye for now. Bye.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of Supernatural Horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the spirit palace?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course.
What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.